Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 12th of May 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is episode number 73 in this series where we look at white contributions to civilization and we look at history in a patriotic way. And the last couple of dozen or so episodes, we've been looking in depth at British history, and we started out the series just with the Patriarch as a co-host, and now we also have Truthvids as a co-host from truthvids.net, and of course the Patriarch is from the Patriotic Arts Community on Telegram. Truthvids, how are you doing, sir? How's life treating you?
All good, Sven. Great to be back as always and talking about our British history.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, and I do enjoy having you two as my co-hosts because you're both just as interested in our history as I am. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
Hi, Sven. Everything's good here. Glad to be back on another episode and looking forward to other bits of our history that we haven't covered yet.
Yeah, we've just basically finished with Canute, haven't we? And Canute's empire, and we've got a short way to go from that to the invasion of William the Conqueror. Most of our notes today will be taken from Sharon Turner, but we'll just begin with a quick summary from R.W. Morgan. He says, after Canute died, in the reign of his son, Harold I, or Harold Harefoot, Alfred, son of Ethelred, and more than 1,000 of his Norman attendants were murdered by Godwin, the Saxon Earl of Kent. Hardicanute, his successor, left the throne after a brief reign to Edward the Confessor, the surviving son of Ethelred, a feeble, superstitious monarch on whose demise in AD 1066, William, Duke of Normandy, claimed the throne and, defeating Harold, his Saxon competitor at Hastings, achieved the conquest of England in one battle on October the 4th, 1066. So he's basically summing up quite a bit of history there, a few decades that we're going to get into in detail here. Any comments you want to make on this summary here, Truthvids, before we begin?
Yeah, as we go through this, we're going to see there's a lot more history, a lot more back and forth. Godwin was actually raised by Canute, and he was basically connected with the Danes and the English. But here we see the power and influence is starting to shift more towards the continent, right, with the Normans and William the Conqueror's family. And gradually the destiny of England would change from being in this Scandinavian kind of influence to more of a continental and heavily eventually involved in wars with France. And that would be the future of England, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating stuff, because I always wondered how it was that we ended up with this Norman king, and when the Normans came into it all, and that's what we're going to be getting into in this episode. Patriarch, any thoughts on this period of history?
Well, just wondering if we're going to be covering the Battle of Hastings 1066 in more detail as well.
Eventually, when we get to it, we have got some notes on the tapestry, which are particularly interesting, and they're very, very detailed. We do have really good notes for this, actually. We're taking all of our notes from Sharon Turner for this rather than from Wikipedia. That's Sharon Turner from the History of the Anglo-Saxons. So beginning with Turner here, Canute, at his death, left three sons, Svein, Harold, and Hardicanute. In his life, he had placed Svein over Norway, and he wished that Harold should rule in England and Hardicanute in Denmark. At the council, which met at Oxford to elect a new sovereign, the opinions were divided. The chiefs of Danish descent and connections chose Harold, but the West Saxons, headed by the Earl Godwin, preferred his brother Hardicanute, because his mother Emma had been the wife of Ethelred and was a favourite with the Anglo-Saxons. The children of Ethelred, who were in Normandy, were also remembered, but the Danish dynasty was not yet unpopular, and Harold, by force or influence, obtained a portion of the kingdom and seized the treasures which Emma possessed from the gift of Canute. Harold at first reigned at London and north of the Thames, and Hardicanute in the west of England. So we see here that there's this connection here between the Saxons and also with the Danes, through the wife of Ethelred that ended up also being married to Canute. I've always find that bizarre that somebody who would be defeated, like a wife who is married to somebody who is defeated, would then end up marrying the person that had murdered their former husband. I mean, you just wouldn't get that going on today, would you? But it was quite a common thing that happened in the past. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly different. I think that Emma was really neglected by Ethelred, and it was actually her son. It wasn't actually her son. It was the son from Ethelred's former wife. So, you know, you can understand she didn't really have a connection. Perhaps she helped raise him. And then because she was neglected and she was actually the daughter of the Norman Robert, I believe, that then she decided to marry, and that way she could remain queen and her, you know, descendants could basically rule. And I think here, Harder Knut, that would be Knut's first son, a son from his first wife in Scandinavia. And Harold was actually the son of Emma. So, and that's why Harder Knut had to try and seize it and steal all the wealth from his mother-in-law, Emma, right? That's how I'm picturing this, if I'm right, right?
It gets confusing, doesn't it, with the extra wives that they have and all the intertwined family trees here. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I was just wondering, what else would happen to the wife otherwise? I mean, the wife of the former king and remarrying, isn't that somewhat sort of in the ballpark of, the king's been redeemed by the kinsman that overtook, and it's almost like an Israelite tradition, isn't it?
That's a really good point, isn't it? You know, the brother was supposed to then marry the wife of the deceased brother so that they still had an income. And I think the other option was to go to a nunnery and run a nunnery. That was pretty much the only other option, I think, thinking about it, because that happened quite a lot with these queens or princesses. They would just end up being an abbess. Well, Harold, though nominated king, could not obtain from the archbishop the regal benediction because the children of Emma were still alive. The archbishop, instead of committing to Harold the crown and scepter, placed them on the altar and forbade the bishops to give their benediction. I mean, this shows you the power that the church had. It was the church that could actually make the king. And if the church wouldn't go along with it, then he wasn't actually king. So this must have really annoyed Harold. This conduct produced the effects which might easily have been foreseen. Harold despised the benediction as useless and contracted a hatred against the Christian religion and against the children of Emma. When others were attending divine service, he called out his hunting dogs, or studied to occupy himself in some contemptuous pursuit. To get the youths, so imprudently set against him, into his power, he forged a letter to them in their mother's name, inveighing against himself, and desiring one to come to her and to be counselled as to his conduct. The answer of the princes from Normandy expressed their obedience, and appointed a day and a place. At the time so named, Alfred, the youngest, chose his military companions and sailed. His waiting enemies too eagerly pressed on him when about to land, and he sailed to another part, still unconscious of the deceit. Godwin, now become a courtier to Harold, met him in the garb of friendship and with the mockery of oaths. The innocent youth followed him to Guildford. There his warlike friends were artfully separated into little bands of 10, 12, or 20 to be more conveniently entertained at different houses. A few only remained with the prince. Food and wine were profusely given to all until they sought the bed of rest. Then the agents of Harold furtively took away their arms and in the morning bound them in chains. Their fate was decided by a bloody decimation. The tenth man only was left unmurdered. The betrayed Alfred was hurried to the Isle of Ely. Vile judges were appointed over him who directed his eyes to be taken out. The shocking scene was closed by his death. Emma withdrew to Bruges. By Harder Knut's absence in Denmark, Harold obtained all of England, and he died in 1040 and was buried at Westminster. And the point of putting out his eyes was so that he would be unfit to rule, because you couldn't have a king that was blinded. I mean, this is a horrible deceit that Godwin has gone into here. And it just shows you, you know, what people will stoop to in their quest for power, to break their oaths like this and to put the guy's eyes out just so that he gets on the right side of the king. And it's awful. It's the sort of thing that Canute punished. I forget what his name is, but Canute punished the one that did similar to Edmund Ironside, who backstabbed Edmund Ironside and had him attacked once he'd actually come to peace with Canute, didn't he? And then Canute punished him, even though he had effectively done this to help Canute. Canute punished him because it was such a dishonourable thing to do. And it's the same thing here. You've got Godwin doing this absolutely horrible, horrible act, conning this young prince to come to Britain, pretending to be his mother, sending him this note. It's just awful. What do you make of these events here, Truefids?
It was Edric, wasn't it? Edric the arch-traitor,
if memory serves. Yeah, Edric, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you can see it's really treacherous. And Godwin is the father of Harold, another Harold, and that would be Harold who fought, you know, marched the English up to fight the Danish invasion and then marched down to fight William and lost. So you can see a bit of Harold's family's character here, that they are, you know, there's a lot of treachery, and it shines a dim light because it's often seen as, oh, he was our English guy and then we were invaded by Normans and then it all changed. But you can see here that there wasn't really a good family, Godwin and Harold, right? So it's interesting to know all this.
Yeah, you can see family traits, can't you? And it was Harold Godwinson that was later on at the end. And just this, knowing about these family traits, I was thinking the other day about this, where you had to, if you wanted to be a druid, you had to show that you'd been a free man for 10 years, or your family had been a free man for 10 years. And it effectively shows that there had been no bad behavior for 10 generations, no bad behavior at all. And what you see here is you see that there's this bad behavior by Harold, and Harold Godwinson, I mean, it's going to taint him as well, because these sort of character defects, they tend to be passed down by the family, and they understood this sort of thing at the time. I mean, what do you make of this horrible, horrible act that took place here, Patriarch?
Well, it seems like a spiteful act. I mean, if reading back, it says, you know, though he was nominated as king, he couldn't obtain it from the archbishop of the regal benediction. So I'm assuming that was his motive, just out of pure spite and anger, wasn't it? And I think things like this obviously start to lead to laws being put in place later, like the Magna Carta. I mean, hypothetically, if what he did would have enabled him to become king, you know, he wouldn't... under the sort of Magna Carta rules, there would be more, his rule would be more questionable, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there was one other son as well, so it wasn't like he'd put all of them out of the picture. But I think also Turner is sort of implying that some of the blame for this may lie with the Archbishop for refusing to accept him as king. And he, you know, he's saying, well, the next things that happened could very easily have been foreseen. So I think he's also placing the blame slightly on the Archbishop for what happened there. Well, next we come to the reign of Harder Canute. This reign demands but few sentences. He had sailed the preceding year from Denmark to his mother Emma at Bruges. On Harold's death, he was invited to the English crown, and he came with purposes of such degrading revenge that he even caused the body of Harold to be dug up, decapitated, and thrown first into a marsh and afterwards into the Thames. A fisherman found the body of the Dane and buried it in a cemetery which they had in London. Such actions have so much of the barbarian spirit as to fix a stain of disgrace on those who practice them. So I think it was Harder Canute's brother, was it, Alfred? Is that what was going on here, Truefids? Is that why he did this? Because it was his brother that had been murdered, do you know?
I think so, yeah. It's complicated, right? Because if Harder Canute is Emma's son, then Alfred would be his half-brother, right? It's all confusing, but yeah, you know, at the same time, Harold would be his half brother as well, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of Harolds here. That this is Harold from Canute, and there's also a later Harold, Harold Godwinson. We keep talking about Godwin, but Harold will come into the picture later, right? That Harold.
So we got two half brothers here. One half brother kills the other half brother, and you got one half brother left. You know, as I say, it's awful what the pursuit of power can do to people. Harder Canute oppressed England with impositions which occasioned great misery. Insurrection followed, and military execution at Worcester added a dreadful catastrophe. He projected to punish Godwin for Alfred's murder, but the Dane had a passion which predominated over his fraternal feeling, and the present of a splendid vessel, profusely gilt and rowed by 80 men in sumptuous apparel and splendid armour, having each on his arm two golden bracelets weighing 16 ounces, expiated the crime of Godwin. He displaced a bishop for joining in the cruelty, who appealed to the same master passion, and escaped. It was, however, a laudable trait of fraternal affection in Harder Canute that he welcomed the arrival of his half-brother Edward into England. The son of Ethelred was a more grateful object to the English than the son of a foreign conqueror. In caressing so kindly a brother so dangerous, Harder Canute displayed a virtue in which an Æthelstan was wanting. His health was frequently assailed by disease, but he ended his two-year reign by an act of intemperance at a nuptial feast at Lambeth. A copious draught, as he stood in the mirthful company, occasioned him to fall senseless to the ground, and he spake no more. He died in June and was buried with Canute at Winchester. His death separated the crowns of England and Denmark, and Magnus, the King of Norway, obtained the Danish sceptre. So this is quite interesting as well. So his love for treasure basically prevented him from punishing the guy that was really responsible for this, Godwin. And then because he had a liking for too much alcohol, he ended up actually killing himself. So, yeah, not a rather an ignoble end to Harder Canute. Any thoughts on this, Treefits?
Yeah, I mean, as the king, he would have access to everything, so you really had to have self-control. If you have, you know, no boundaries, nobody can tell you. You can do whatever you want. So as a king, you really had to control if you had a drinking habit. And here it costs him his life in the end, right? And this is basically the end of Canute, right? The great Canute. He had three sons, right? Three potential. And in the end, it all came to nothing. But that's just the way it is, right? No kingly line would last forever. Only Christ, right? Only David's line would reign forever in the Bible. And all these dynasties probably do descend from David, but none of them would ever, reign forever. There would always be infighting. That was the curse of David. And here it's going to switch over to the Normans after this, who would gain a brief few generations as well, right?
So interesting, the description as well of this wondrous vessel that was given as well, you know, with being rowed by 80 men with golden bracelets on their arms, huge, great golden bracelets, this big present, profusely gilt. So the ship must have been covered in gold as well, maybe covered in precious stones and all. It's quite incredible. I'd like to know what actually happened to this ship. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
I guess it just re-highlights a lot of the, examples of how, you know, the offspring of great kings are just a sort of, kind of live within their shadow and just, they're not half the man that they were simply because they experienced different times. And, Canute was obviously, seeking power for himself and was driven by that. And I think, you know, his siblings probably grew up with more wealth and luxury and therefore wasn't as battle hardened and in spirit and in mind and body.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, the way that usually the immediate son afterwards is not a patch on the father. I think we can even see that today with the Duke of Edinburgh, who was a fantastic alpha male, and then his son is King Charles, and I don't think King Charles is a patch on the Iron Duke. And I think we see the same sort of thing happening here in history, don't we? We see this great King Canute and then his sons. None of them were really of them were up to much. But the kingly line, because that is the line of the monarchy, the chances are a couple of generations later, you might get a really good king out of it. So you would get a good king every so often from this line. But the chances are after a good king that the next direct one in line would be in his shadow. And wouldn't be so good. It is interesting the way these things that we observe in history get repeated. Just as I say today, it seems to be being repeated today with our new King Charles. Well, the Danish line had now become unpopular. The lost factions, which the administration of Dunstan had at first excited, had ceased, and a new generation had arisen. The nation inclined again to its ancient line, and Edward, the surviving son of Ethelred, and at that time in England, was chosen to be king. While Edward and his brother were friendless exiles, Godwin was their enemy and even projected their assassination, but became the zealous partisan of Edward and eagerly assisted to introduce him to the throne when Canute's issue failed. The king was induced to marry Editha, the daughter of Godwin, but was neither ardent in his connubial nor filial attentions. At no long period after his coronation, he went with three earls suddenly to his mother and spoiled her of all the property which she possessed. Can you expand upon that, Truthfitz? I mean, why would he suddenly go to his mother and take all the property which she had? Was this just out of jealousy or what do you think?
I'm not sure. Maybe that just wasn't a particularly good relationship. Edward needed the money. His mother didn't. You know, perhaps she lived in luxury and he needed it. So he just went and took it. You know, when a king left his wealth or you know, it wasn't always to the son. Sometimes a lot would be left to the wife. I'm not sure. But speaking to where he married Godwin's daughter, I think between the lines it's saying that he wasn't really, sleeping with her, and that's why he ends up with no heir in the end, which comes back to haunt him, right? Even if he didn't get on with her. I'm not sure the timeline here, if he lived, say, 10, 20 years, if he had have just been with his wife, he could have had heirs here. So it was silly of him to do that, right? Even if he didn't get on, it would have been a good thing to have a family.
Yeah, he should have certainly have produced an heir, and perhaps it was that the queen mother, perhaps she, because she was she was still royalty, perhaps she had all the crown jewels. Perhaps he had a right to this, and that's why he had gone there to take it. Patriarch, do you want to add any comments to this?
Well, just off those instances of him not feeling so ardent towards marrying, and then obviously, you know, taking property and possessions off his mother, he clearly didn't have much respect for women, or he didn't feel a connection to women. So I don't know where that would have come from. But like Truthfitz says, it clearly backfired on him. You know, you're supposed to honour your father and mother, and you know, and that's, he obviously paid the price with a lack of heir.
Well, he certainly did. Yeah, so again, that's a good point, honouring your father and your mother. Well, Edward was at first menaced with the competition of Magnus, the King of Norway, who had subdued Denmark into obedience. Magnus sent letters to Edward claiming the crown, and Edward assembled a great fleet at Sandwich to dispute his landing. Embarrassed by a rival for his Danish sceptre in Svein, the son of Ulfa, Magnus resolved not to risk the enterprise. Svein requested the aid of Edward against Magnus, and Godwin, whose first patron had been Svein's father, urged that 50 ships should be sent to him. But as Magnus was known to be well skilled in maritime affairs, the Earl Leofric and the rest of the council opposed it as unadvisable. Magnus soon drove out Svein from Denmark, but died, much lamented, the same year. Svein then obtained the Danish crown, and Harald Hardrada, who afterwards perished in his invasion of England, the son of Sigurd Syr, and by his mother, the brother of St. Olaf, succeeded in Norway. Harald is highly extolled for his wisdom, he sent letters of friendship to Edward, whose amicable answer established peace between their kingdoms, thus passed over the disturbing question between England and the Baltic states. I guess they should really say Scandinavian states now. Edward and his council wisely suffered the hostility to die quietly away. Hence Svein's second application for assistance against Harold, though again supported by Godwin, was negatived by the good sense of Leofric and the community. And I think we find out more about Leofric. He was a good advisor. The character of Edward was amiable for its gentleness and its kindness, and laudable for its piety. But it did not unite strength of mind with those interesting qualities. There is a simplicity in his exclamation to the low peasant who had displeased him, "I would hurt you if I were able," which almost implies imbecility. Men of rank and power, however inferior in understanding, know sufficiently their means of aggression against those of meaner condition who offend them. That Edward, when angry enough to desire to punish, should suppose that, although king, he had not the power, displays an ignorance of his authority that is not reconcilable with his intellect. But as he reigned with more virtue, so he had better fortune than his father. His mild and equitable government was so popular that a festival is said to have been annually celebrated in England to express the national joy at the deliverance from the Danish kings. His provinces were under the administration of men of talents appointed by his predecessors. The unanimity of the country gave effect to their measures. England again became respected abroad, and no foreign power attempted to disturb its tranquility. So quite clearly, the English people are very pleased about this. They've got rid of the Danish kings. They're having a festival once a year. But we have this rather bizarre instance here with this peasant where he said, "I would hurt you if I were able to." I mean, maybe he was saying that he wasn't going to do it because that would be wrong of him to do it. I mean, it is hard to reconcile with him, like, having an intellect as well. I mean, what do you make of what's going on here, Truefitz?
Yeah, it seems that he was a gentle, kind man, but, you know, perhaps he wasn't ruthless. He wasn't as intelligent and sharp as other kings, so perhaps quite weak-willed. But as it's explained here, the earls around him had been set up by previous kings, so the kingdom was running well. You know, sometimes if you have a weak king, you have all the surrounding people, you know, you end up with slimy people start to seize power. But here it seems to be going well. Of course, later on, we're going to see that Godwin is going to come back and try to seize power. Back to Sven, that's actually the son of, how do you pronounce it? Ufrul. It's just four letters, right? Ufrul. That's the one that Canute died, that murdered, and later regretted. So in the end, his sons ended up ruling over Denmark anyways. And then we have yet another Harold. This is like the third Harold. So it's getting really, really complicated. This is the one who was banished when Canute took Sweden and Norway, and he's went down to Poland first, then to the Byzantine Empire, served as a mercenary, and then when everyone's died, he's come back, and then he's going to contest the throne for England later as well, right?
So he must have been really battle-hardened by that time, if he's going all the way to the Byzantine and fighting for them and made his way through Poland. I mean, he's going to be a knight of quite some renown by this time. And then you've got Edward, who is too timid to even reprimand a peasant. But it does say that he was known for his gentleness and his kindness. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I'm just trying to sort of connect the, you know, where it says deliverance of the Danish kings with Edward, who was obviously a sort of a more gentle leader. Normally them two things kind of don't go together, do they? So how did they embellish this deliverance, or how did that come about? Was it just something that was kind of just naturally taken root and was just kind of the tether end of being finalised?
Well, it was no longer one of the sons of Canute. that was in charge here. It was Edward, who was the sons of the Saxon kings. So that's why they managed to get rid of the Danish kings. But we'll also see later on that he got rid of the Danegeld as well. A rather interesting incident when we get to it. But at this point as well, the Normans then enter the scene. A new cause of internal discussion and contest, and ultimately of a great revolution, was silently rising up from preceding events. The marriage of Ethelred to a princess of Normandy, the Frankish nation had rapidly improved since the reign of Charlemagne. The effects of the Roman civilization were extensive and permanent, and the ardent zeal of the Christian clergy had greatly contributed to humanize and soften their martial fierceness. The unwarlike characters of the successors of Charlemagne had tended to increase the civilizing spirit, and the Normans, from their contiguity, partook of the melioration of the French manners, and to Edward's milder temper, these were peculiarly congenial. The Anglo-Saxons could not have been equally improved by the ruder Danes. Hence Edward found at first more than he could sympathise with in Normandy than in England, and therefore invited or admitted many Normans into his favour. Robert, one of them, was made, after various promotions, Archbishop of Canterbury. Another was raised to an episcopal see. Others also attained offices of rank and power. From the king's partiality, the French manners came into use. Their language and their legal forms began also to be diffused. But the Norman favourites awakened the jealousy of Godwin and were obstacles to his ambition. But the counteracting power of Leofric, the wise Earl of Mercia, and of Siward, the Earl of Northumbria, and distinguished for heroic valour, kept Godwin tranquil until a cruel violence of one of the noble foreigners gave him a popular reason for expressing his discontent. So that's interesting, because you tend to think of William the Conqueror and the Normans coming over as being quite barbaric and beating the hell out of the Saxons. But apparently what it's saying here is they were greatly civilised. And obviously they must have had a chivalrous character to them rather than being warlike. Because you do tend to think of William the Conqueror. I mean, he was known as William the Bastard as well. And although that's due to the circumstances of his birth, he was also a pretty nasty person by all accounts. But what they're saying here is that these Normans were a nicer people, a softer people, basically, than the Saxons, who had had this influence of the Danes, who must have been more warlike and less civilized. And I remember also Alfred the Great looked up to Charlemagne as well, and the civilization, the empire that Charlemagne started. So, and they must have been continuing that over there in France, all the while that we were having these problems over here in England with the Vikings, first with the Vikings, and then with the Danes. We haven't really had time to build a civilization. We had that brief period with Alfred the Great, where there was this great flowering of the arts. But I mean, from what it's saying here, there's been like a century or more where they've had a great flowering of the arts over in France, and that's where you get these Normans that are more educated, I guess. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, generally a more civilized society conquers a less civilized society, right? With the Norman invasion, because you have better technology, you know, when you're civilized, and you have better discipline. And, you know, we will get perhaps to the battle one day later, but you'll see that the Norman, you know, army was far better organized than Harold's one. He had cavalry, he had archers, all different divisions, whilst Harold was just a big army of foot soldiers, right? And I looked up the Robert who he appointed the Archbishop. So Archbishop would have had an enormous influence over the country, right? And it was him who suggested banishing Godwin. And he's the one who traveled over to Normandy and told William that he's going to inherit the throne. So he must have influenced Edward and said, look, let's make William your heir. And then later Godwin got him exiled. So Robert actually went to the Pope of Rome, and that's how William got the support from the papacy in the invasion. So Robert had a huge play, you know, behind the scenes in, you know, the gradual power shift to the Normans.
So an absolutely massive influence that came in there from them. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
No, I was just wondering a bit of about the Northmen. I always thought that they were kind of typically a sect of Vikings, but they were sort of a collection of settlers, weren't they? Between sort of the, they would have, I'm assuming there would have been some that kind of stretched over from the British Isles, and then some Celts and Romans and some Vikings mixed in.
Well, I think the Normans were a branch of the Cymmerians. They were a branch of the Cymry, so they were sort of more related to the Welsh than they were actually to the Saxons. From some of the stuff that we looked into earlier that R.W. Morgan was discussing. I think you said they came from the Cymric Chersonese, perhaps?
I think they actually came from Norway, but they were highly pirates. And one of the kings banished piracy, and then in the end, because they were still committing piracy, he banished Rollo, who's the ancestor of William, and he set up a colony on, the north of France. That's at least him, right? But there could have been other people who combined with him, you know, Cymry and Welsh and etc. But Rollo's line, at least, he was from Norway, and that's where Northmen slowly got, shrunk to Norman.
And R.W. Morgan is definitely more sympathetic to the Norman kings than he is to the Saxon kings. And he's very much against the Saxon kings. I think he said it was when the Tudor kings came in, it was somebody that had a direct line to the princely lines of Wales. But he's definitely more sympathetic to the Normans. And I'm sure I remember there being some link between the Cymmerians and the Normans some way back. But also I was just thinking there about, you know, we're talking about this civilizing influence of the Normans and how technologically advanced they were. And if you look at their castles that they built, they're just absolutely incredible. You know, these Norman castles that are still standing today, and you think they built them without any blueprints. I mean, we don't know if what measures they had, but everything was just built by eye. And it's absolutely incredible when you look at them. I mean, the circular towers that they've got, which was modeled on the Byzantine castles that they had there. And a lot of them are still standing today. There's dozens of them in Wales. I'm not quite sure how many there are in England. But I mean, that just shows you how technologically advanced they were, because you don't really have Saxon castles from before then or anything really that's built of stone from the Saxons that survived. It's all Norman stuff. I think with the Saxons, you might get churches with square towers. I think that's a sign that a church was maybe built by the Saxons. And then you get the more ornate style of the Normans. So you can see that they were a lot more advanced, where they'd had the time to advance and they'd have this peaceful time under Charlemagne's empire after they'd deterred the Islamic army that was coming after them, Charles the Hammer. Well, let's get into this rebellion of Godwin's here. It was in 1051 that Godwin presumed to give defiance to the king. The Count of Boulogne, who had married Edward's sister, came to Dover. In a foolish effort to obtain or compel entertainment, his followers killed an Englishman. The citizens revenged it. The Count, committing himself to the guidance of blind fury, rushed with his troops and killed many of both sexes in the city, and trampled some children under the feet of their horses. Provoked at his brutality, the people armed, and the endangered Count fled before their indignation and went to Edward, who was then at Gloucester. Availing himself of this event, Godwin raised immediately from his own counties of Kent, Sussex, and Wessex a military power. The same occasion enabled his son Svein to collect a powerful force from the counties of Oxford, Gloucester, Hereford, Somerset, and Berkshire, which he governed, and Harold, another son, embracing the same pretext, completed his formidable array by a levy from Essex, East Anglia, Huntingdon, and Cambridgeshire, which he commanded. The armies of Godwin and his children could not be completed without Edward's knowledge. Messengers were immediately sent to his brave protectors, Leofric and Siward. These governors were earnestly desired to come with all the forces they could assemble and with immediate speed. The loyal earls hastened immediately to court. Learning the necessity, they sent swiftly circulated orders throughout all their counties for armies to be raised. The son of the culpable count did the same, and Edward had a prospect of being rescued from the tyranny of Godwin. The rebellious family marched into Gloucestershire and demanded of the king, under a menace of hostilities, the Count of Boulogne and his followers, and the Normans and the men of Boulogne who were in Dover Castle. The king, terrified, knew not how to act. He fluctuated in great anxiety till he learnt that his friends were prepared to support him. An express refusal was then returned to Godwin. A fierce civil war seemed now about to consume the country, but Godwin was not heroically adventurous, and Leofric was wise. Leofric therefore proposed that hostages should be exchanged, and that Godwin and the king should meet on an appointed day in London and have the alleged subject judicially determined by the Witenagemot. Interesting here is that Godwin is still being portrayed in a negative view here, and I think Godwin was doing the right thing. I mean, this count had come over from France, and he just murdered an Englishman for sport, and Godwin has said, well, this is, you know, this is not on. So he's got the military together and said, you've got to hand over this count that just killed one of the Englishmen. So I can't say that Godwin was too wrong there to do that. I mean, obviously he was breaking his oath by going against the king. So you could say, well, that takes precedence and he should not have broken his oath. But at the same time, somebody needed to be standing up for these children that had been trampled and this person that had been killed. And if Edward the Confessor wasn't going to stand up for them, obviously somebody else would. So difficult situation, isn't it? Do you break your oath and you don't avenge the people that have been killed, or do you break your oath and then be accused of being an oath breaker and disloyal to the king? It's a difficult situation, I think. And obviously Turner is of the view that Godwin was in the wrong here. Any thoughts on this, Treefids?
Yeah, the characters aren't always black and white. That some, you know, they'll do good things and then they'll do bad things. Like earlier, he's helping Hardknut and the other Harold in murdering you know, the princes to gain power. And here, perhaps he did a good thing. It's hard to know, you know, 1,000 years how it exactly happened, you know, time ago. But yeah, you can see that basically Godwin's got all his sons, and you also see the amount of power he had, you know, with all his sons being counts over all these territories. He had an enormous amount of influence, and he wanted the Normans gone. Perhaps there is something else behind the scenes. Perhaps he just used this as a pretext so that he could get rid of the Normans, because he didn't like the power the Normans were starting to wield over, you know, the power and influence over the king. And if there was no heir, perhaps he was beginning to plot that one of his sons could be king, which did happen, right, Harold?
Yeah, so we've just managed to get rid of the Danes, but now we've got this threat of the Normans coming in there. And, you know, these Normans obviously weren't so kind-hearted as we thought. If they're going to start killing Englishmen for sport, Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think he was probably sort of, you know, either biding his time or just, you know, not... just had contempt for the changes that he saw, and eventually just, you know, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, and perhaps it just pushed him over the edge. And, you know, he felt like he felt compelled to do something. Whether he was in the right or wrong, I don't know, but I guess these things happen, and I guess the end result really kind of determines whether it was right or wrong, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think cooler heads prevailed, didn't they? This Leofric and Siward said, well, look, you know, we don't want to have a civil war here. This should be sorted out by the courts. You know, we should get the Witenagemot together and you know, this will be decided in a court of law, what the result of this should be. So, you know, that also shows us the way that the legal system had evolved by that time as well, and it could be used here to prevent a civil war. The proposition was too popular not to be accepted. Godwin returned to Wessex, and the king ordered a Witenagemot to be assembled for the second time in London at the autumnal equinox. He augmented his army and marched it to London. Godwin and his sons occupied Southwark, but soon discovered that their partisans were falling away. The Witenagemot made the Thanes, who were with Harold, to find pledges to the king for their conduct and outlawed Svein, who did not think fit to be present at the Wittinggamot or at the conciliar meeting. They also cited Godwin and Harald to attend the Gamot. Godwin, finding his ambitious views darkening and dreading a legal inquiry into his conduct, did not attempt to face the Wittinggamot but fled into the night. In the morning, the king held the Wittinggamot and declared him, his army, and his children tot outlaws. 5 days of safety were given them to quit the country. With three of his sons, Godwin sailed away with all the property he could hastily amass into Flanders. Harald and a brother from Bristol sailed into Ireland. A severe tempest put their lives in peril during the voyage, and their sister, the queen, was sent to a monastery. So here we see these queens, the other option to them, if they didn't marry, was to be sent to a monastery. And because Godwin refused to come to the Wittinggamot, I guess that's like refusing to come to court. You know, if you don't turn up at court, then an arrest warrant is going to be sent out for you, isn't it? So, I mean, that's what happened here. He did not want a legal inquiry to be made into his conduct. So he obviously didn't feel that he'd actually done the right thing there to go after this Frenchman that had killed the Englishman. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, so basically all the nobles probably abandoned him. They didn't want to go against the king, and they weren't willing to stand up for the peasants, right? That was just the way it was back then, right? And where it says that he sent the queen to the monastery, obviously that's Godwin's daughter, that's Harold's sister. So by doing that, Edward obviously, again, is not going to have an heir because he just got rid of his wife, right? And there's no evidence, I think, that he remarried or anything.
So that was his wife then. I do get confused here with whether it's the mother's or the wife. So he sent his own wife, get thee to a nunnery. Yeah, what do you make of this patriarch?
Well, I guess it goes to show that, he didn't really have, not necessarily true cause, but if the majority of people didn't feel enthusiastic, or they clearly weren't bothered as much as Godwin, so maybe he was in the wrong and he had some his own personal issues that prevailed over issues that he kind of was projecting onto the good of the people.
Yeah, he didn't have enough faith in his own righteousness, did he? In the righteousness of his cause, he obviously thought that he was in the wrong, and it was really just an expression of power, and hopefully to get enough people to depose the king. That's what it looks like, and that's obviously the way that King Edward looked at it. Well, next up we have the introduction of William the Norman onto the scene. Contrary to every natural expectation and to his own, and to the astonishment of the Anglo-Saxons, the House of Godwin seemed now to have fallen forever in England. Released from his intimidations, the king became even more attached to his Norman friends. Invited or obeying a sagacious policy, William, the reigning Duke of Normandy, came to England with a large company of his nobles and knights at this period, and was received with great honour and courtesy by Edward, who entertained him for some time, conducted him to his cities and royal castles, and loaded him with presents when he returned. This visit was of importance to William. It introduced him to the knowledge of many of the English chiefs, and made his name familiar to the people. It began the formation of that interest which so powerfully assisted him in afterwards acquiring the crown. But Ingulf declares that no mention was made of his succession to the crown at this visit, nor had he then any hope of it. Yet it may have excited William's desire to enjoy such a crown, and must have made a lively impression on his memory. Edward was then living without a prospect of issue, and excepting one youth in Hungary, the crown had no heir. The family of William was connected with that of Edward by marriage, and with Edward himself by friendship and services. William was a neighbour, and Edward esteemed him. The family of Godwin was abased, and no competitor seemed likely to arise from the rest of the English. William, therefore, from this time, could scarcely contemplate the throne of his friend without coveting its acquisition. Any valued good which seems bending to our reach soon excites our cupidity. He may have had the prudence to mark the hopeful ground in judicious silence, but the scheme of his succession must have been a project which his mind revolved and secretly prepared to execute. So here we see that William was invited over to England, given all these presents, received with honours by the king, and because he was related to him and because the king did not have any heir of his own, it must have crossed his mind that he could actually be next in line for the crown. And also we can see here that with once Godwin's gone, Edward the Confessor becomes even more interested in his Norman friends. I mean, it doesn't tell us about any prescription that was made on this duke or this earl that had come over and killed this Anglo-Saxon. We're not told that he was punished in any way, and it seems to have made Edward even all the more friendly with the Normans after this. What do you make of this, Truefitz?
Yeah, I was just looking at the timelines. Edward was born 1003, so I don't know what time period this happened, but he must have been getting on by now, maybe, you know, in his 50s or late 40s, whilst William was quite young here. He must have just been in his 20s or so. So, you know, full of ambition. And here he's also bringing all his nobles. And we learn in the Norman invasion, he rewarded all his nobles. You know, they became barons and gained enormous districts. So they would be seeing England as well and would really, you know, if they moved to England, they would gain enormous amounts of land compared to Normandy if they supported William in the later invasion. So I had no idea that William actually came over, but it makes sense that he would see England and then contemplate an invasion at a later point, right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, he would make alliances, wouldn't he, with the people? And obviously he was favoured by Edward. All these gifts that Edward gave to him, he obviously thought very, very highly of him. And I guess it also shows us that these kings would try to outdo one another with all the gifts that they would bestow upon the people that came into their country. I mean, Alfred the Great was like that. Anybody that visited from another country, you know, they would be given all sorts of lavish gifts to take with them. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
Well, I'm wondering why Edward had no heir, and why, was he seeking an heir? You know, he's married, but, you know, maybe he was inviting towards, William for a reason.
Either he refused to perform his duty to his queen, or perhaps the queen was barren. We don't know. And the queen was a relation of Godwin's, wasn't it? It was a daughter of Godwin's, I think. So either he didn't perform for the queen, or the queen was barren. And that resulted in there not being an heir. Unlike these Danish kings that, you know, could have more than one wife, all he had was you know, his wife here, and he's just banished her to a nunnery because of his views towards Godwin.
Do you think William kind of saw an opportunity there and kind of made moves with preempting that before Edward sort of showered him with gifts and was so welcoming?
Yeah, I mean, it could have been. I mean, what Turner seems to be saying is if he hadn't already done so, he definitely must have done so after this visit to England. You know, it must have gone round in his mind that he could be the ruler of England. But whether he thought of that beforehand, we don't know. And, you know, we don't know for certain whether Edward did say to him, well, you can rule after me, because that is what the Normans said, but the Saxons said otherwise. So we don't know. I mean, we'll get into the different reports of why it was that William thought he should be king when we actually get to it. Next up, the family of Godwin returns. The family of Godwin, in their exile, meditated new low attempts to regain their power. Harold and his brother invaded the west of England with a fleet of adventurers collected in Ireland, defeated the king's officers, and plundered as they pleased. As Godwin was impending with a similar armament, a chosen force of 40 ships was stationed at Sandwich to intercept it. He eluded their vigilance, reached Kent, and roused all his friends in the neighbouring counties to arm on his behalf. But the king's fleet pursued him. He sheltered himself in Pevensey. A storm checked the progress of the others, and when they made for London, he hovered about the Isle of Wight, where Harold joined him after a voyage of plunder. With a united strength, swelled by every aid they could allure, they sailed to Sandwich. Edward found his friends more tardy than before. Other nobles became dissatisfied at the progress of the Normans in the king's favour, and Godwin proceeded with successful enterprise to the Thames and reached Southwark. He demanded the restoration of his family. His numbers and secret connections were formidable, and to save the shedding of civil blood, Stigand, the archbishop, and the wise men urged an accommodation, and their recommendation prevailed. The Normans beheld their fate sealed in the pacification and fled in consternation. A great council was then convened out of London, and all the earls and the best men that were in the land attended it. Godwin there purged himself before the king, his lord, and all the assembly that he was guiltless of the crime of which he had been suspected. The king received him in full friendship and granted to him and to his family a complete restoration of their honours, and the Normans were all legally outlawed. Svein was the only one of the exiled family who received no benefit from the revolution of its fortunes. He had foully murdered his cousin Bjorn, with every aggravated circumstance of abused confidence and treacherous falsehood. There is a sting in murder which goads the consciousness long after the world has forgiven it, and which no increase in prosperity can destroy. Svein, though 6 years had passed away since his crime, found it still to his torment, and to soothe his sensations he set off with naked feet on a walking pilgrimage from Flanders to Jerusalem. He died on his return in Lycia. The remark of the Hebrew poet that man disquiets himself for a vain shadow is often verified in human history. A life is sacrificed to suffering that a favourite object may be gained. We reach the seat of the felicity we have sighed for, and while our arms are extended to grasp it, we are received into the grave. Godwin experienced this mutability in human affairs. He had scarcely, by great toil and hazard, achieved his restoration and recovered his prosperity when he was deprived of it soon afterwards by death. In 1054, at the Easter festival, the eventful changes of his life were closed. As he sat with the king at table, it is said that the conversation turned to Alfred's murder, and that Godwin, with many sacred appeals to divine providence, denied that he was concerned in it. But whatever was the preceding discourse, the attack of fate was as irresistible as unexpected. He suddenly lost his speech and fell from his seat. Harold and two other sons raised him and carried him to the king's chamber, hoping a recovery. But he lingered in helpless and miserable agony from Monday to Thursday, and then expired. Very interesting. So he literally dies straight after claiming that it wasn't him and that he wasn't responsible for the murder of Alfred. So I guess he must have been swearing on his life that what he was saying was true. And then he ended up losing his life. I'm surprised that the Normans just left at this point. I mean, it must have been because the people that were there, the Saxons, didn't all flock to Edward's standard when Harold and his and Godwin's army were coming for them, and he must have realized that meant that he was losing his loyalty from his own people because he was placing too much faith in these Normans. So I guess that's what must have lay behind this. What do you make of this, Truefitz?
Yeah, it seems like God just struck Godwin down there, doesn't it? That you know, he could have probably just confessed and say, "Yeah, okay, I did it. I regret it. I'm sorry." But there, he like seems to swear on his life, and he absolutely denies it, and he just drops dead. You know, as for the invasion, it seems that all the sons scattered. I believe Harold went to Ireland, Godwin to Flanders, right? That would be Holland. And they must have gathered armies and mercenaries, and then they've all invaded England from different points and then met up eventually. And this is, you know, took the king by complete surprise, and probably many years have passed. And maybe originally many of the other nobles and Saxons were fed up with Godwin's family, but now they're getting fed up with the Normans, and they don't want to fight for the Normans, right? Godwin basically all he wants is to be restored, and the Normans gone. And the other nobles are, you know, that they're happy with that. And at the same time, the king was probably getting frail by this point and, you know, close to death, right?
Yeah, there must have been a great show of strength as well. All of these ships that suddenly appear, all prepared to fight on the side of Godwin. So it's not just him swearing his oath of fealty to the king once again. It's also all this power and might that he's amassed behind him. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Well, it all seems very coordinated, doesn't it? And I don't know, with it being an Easter festival, I wonder if he may have been subject to poisoning. Obviously, it could have been sort of God's will intervening, but since we know it was at a festival, it could have been poisoning, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it could have been. That's a good point there. I mean, that I don't know if that was questioned at the time or not. We should probably leave that here for now. Any final thoughts for today, Truefitz, before we finish?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I had no idea that Harold had such an extensive, history that you realize he's being banished, invading. There's all these petty, like, minor wars and struggles ensuing, and this is all before the William the Conqueror. So even Harold was, you know, a military commander as well. He had a lot of experience, and I look forward to getting into it, because I know there's a Welsh rebellion that comes on, and most people don't know about all of this. So, yeah, look forward to it.
Yeah, it's completely new to me. I mean, I've never really studied this little portion of history before, so it's fascinating to find out all the intricacies that went on, and how the Normans came onto the scene, and what was going on here with the last of these Saxon kings, and all the intrigues. Patriarch, any final thoughts on everything today?
I think this kind of gives a bit of background as to what was going off with, you know, within Britain and Europe and our focus. And obviously, not long after this, we get to the Crusades, don't we? The First Crusade. And if I recall, we lost, didn't we, the First Crusade? And I think a lot of these wars probably were one of the reasons why, because we had so much in-group fighting that we weren't able to dominate elsewhere, because we'd been kind of weakened ourselves, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting. We also see this penance here, walking pilgrimage from Flanders to Jerusalem without any shoes on, basically. So obviously we had this connection with Jerusalem at this time. It was after that, I think, that we had the Crusades. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truefitz.
Thanks for having me, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And do remember to check out the Patriotic History Archive for earlier episodes. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.